Today, May 27, 2003, and colleagues will, the order that we'll go in today is first the work session on possible introduction of speaker-approved bills or speaker-approved venture drafting requests. Then we will have a public hearing on Senate Bill 708 and 709 together, and then we will have a public hearing on Senate Bill 886 and Senate Bill 538. And hopefully still look to 3 o'clock because it's time for us to get out of here, but we will wait and see. So with that, let's open up a work session on possible introduction of drafting requests and bills.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Legislative Council drafts 3614, 3641, and 3645 be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Flores has moved Legislative Council drafts 3614, 3641, and 3645 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objections? If not, so ordered. Any others on those? Okay, so that closes that work session. And we'll open up a public hearing, combined public hearing on Senate Bill 708 and 709. Representative Monis Anderson, do you want to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lori Monis Anderson, state representative from Gresham, and I am happy to come before you with some comments about Senate Bill 708. Basically, nurse practitioners would be able to dispense medication. Right now, they can administer drugs, they can prescribe drugs, they can dispense sample drugs, but they currently cannot dispense prescriptions to their patients. And what this bill would allow would be for them to dispense. This is particularly, they don't want to become pharmacists, but what they would like to do is when they have patients that have prescriptions and they know they cannot access prescriptions, whether for financial reasons or geographic access, they are not, this bill would allow them to be able to keep some drugs in their clinic or office and dispense them. And with that, I think there are others who would like to speak to it, and it's a good bill and it should pass.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe not today.
Okay, Susan King.
Good afternoon, Chairman Doyle and members of the committee. I'll speak on behalf of both Senate Bill 708A and 709A and distinguish for you the differences and then identify the similarities and then certainly be happy to answer any questions. These bills relate to two different categories of what we call advanced practice nurses. Nurse practitioners is in Senate Bill 708, and clinical nurse specialists are in 709. In terms of Senate Bill 709, clinical nurse specialists are master's prepared nurses who have additional pharmacology and who need to prescribe and dispense to their patients in certain circumstances, and let me give you a couple of examples. There's a clinical nurse specialist who practices here in Salem, Oregon, and her specialty is in pain management, assisting people with both acute and chronic pain, working with nurses and physicians to develop treatment plans so that patients can have adequate pain management. In her role currently, she is consulted, as I said, by both nurses and physicians. Oftentimes, the physicians refers patients to her. She develops the plan, but must now seek a physician or a nurse practitioner to prescribe the drugs that she herself has identified as part of the treatment plan. This bill would authorize clinical nurse specialists, such as the one I'm describing, to prescribe those drugs. Senate Bill 708 and 709 deal with an issue called dispensing. Currently, both advanced practice nurses can administer medications, as can any RN. Nurse practitioners can prescribe medications, they can distribute samples, and they can dispense in certain circumstances. What 708 will do is broaden that dispensing authority with certain safeguards in place that have been worked out through our discussions with the pharmacists, so that medications can be given to the nurse practitioner's patients. And let me cite an example where dispensing will be important for both nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists. Many drug companies currently offer what is called patient assistance programs, and these are programs which offer indigent patients or patients who have large numbers of drugs and therefore very high drug bills to apply for a program where the prescription drugs are actually sent from the manufacturer to the prescribing provider. In this case, it would be either a nurse practitioner or a clinical nurse specialist, and those drugs are then given to the patient. The requirements of most of the drug companies are that the prescribing provider also have the authority to dispense. And so if these bills pass, we will have an opportunity for the patients of both nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists to help their patients participate in what has become a very critical program, particularly given the state of the economy here in Oregon. So those are the reasons that we need dispensing authority for both clinical nurse specialists and nurse practitioners. We have a growing number of people in this state, as you are more aware than I'm sure, who are unable to afford their medications yet must have them to live. And the dispensing authority is going to be a dramatic change for our advanced practice nurses in helping their patients to participate in those programs. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like you to respond to an email that I got from a constituent who is a PharmD candidate. I assume that's a PhD in pharmacy. Saying he's deeply concerned about the impact on these bills, that nurses aren't as trained as the pharmacists are, and he feels it's dangerous for patients. So he's saying it's a safety issue. How do you respond to that?
Well, first and foremost, the amendments that are embodied in the A version of the bills that you have in front of you have put in place some safeguards that we have worked out in our discussions with the pharmacists. Those have to do with training, with labeling, with adequate reference material. The second thing that I would say is that neither nurse practitioners nor clinical nurse specialists intend to dispense all drugs available. Rather, they're more likely to dispense some limited prescriptions around certain kinds of problems. And let me give you some examples. One thing that happens frequently is the patient has an acute infection. The patient perhaps can't afford the medication, and so the provider could dispense a short-term course of antibiotics. Patient has an acute back injury, so they need muscle relaxants, so the provider could dispense a short-term course of muscle relaxants for the acute injury. Or a patient has had a seizure, and then they're unable to fill a prescription for anti-seizure medications for a short term. Those would be the scenarios in which the nurse practitioner or clinical specialist who can already prescribe those drugs would also be able to dispense them.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Fine, I'm not having any trouble with the nurse practitioner. I understand exactly who that is. Mm-hmm. But I'm having a little trouble in figuring out the other. You mentioned working with people with psychological problems. And then another person mentions working with cancer patients. So help me understand a little bit what this what clinical nurse specialists do.
Certainly. Clinical nurse specialists have actually existed in the country for much longer than nurse practitioners. However, in Oregon, nurse practitioners have been much more predominant and are more commonly known by all of us. Clinical nurse specialists are master's prepared at a minimum. If they get prescribing authority, they will have the same pharmacology preparation that nurse practitioners do. They differ from nurse practitioners in that they typically are not primary providers, so that you or I would not name a clinical nurse specialist as our person that we saw for any health problems. Rather, they typically deal with specialty problems, so that the person that you identify that works with patients who have cancer might work for a hospital, actually, and deal specifically with those types of patients, assisting both nurses and physicians to understand better how their treatment could be managed. So they wouldn't typically have an office where you or I would go for our regular health care, but they would deal with more specialty problems, much like a neurosurgeon wouldn't be a primary provider, but clinical nurse specialist would be in that same vein in a specialty role.
I think one of the things that worries me is that in my office, we are encouraging people to go to Pfizer and to other pharmaceutical places that are providing help for indigent medical needs. And so I want to understand exactly how that process works. I thought that it would go to a physician, but you're telling me that those drugs can actually go to someone like you, and you would be the dispensing person.
Yes. In terms of the indigent drug programs, as most of the companies require that whoever writes the prescription must have the authority to dispense the drugs. So if I wrote the prescription for the patient, they could either take that prescription to a pharmacy or I could apply with them to the drug company, and the drugs would actually come back to me to be given to the patient. They would be pre-labeled and, you know, packaged with the patient's name.
A follow-up, please.
Sure, follow-up.
Can you do that now?
Clinical nurse specialist cannot dispense.
Clinical cannot dispense.
Cannot dispense at this time. Nurse practitioners can dispense in certain circumstances, in emergency circumstances, which generally have been geographic, and in places like college health and public health. There are specific scenarios for those. So nurse practitioners can currently, clinical nurse specialists cannot yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you. These bills are important, I think, to the nursing profession, and the main reason I'm a proponent is because of access. Right now, it's so important for us to make sure that all patients have access to proper care. And would you address the types of access issues that the nurses are encountering, the nurse practitioners and the nurse specialists? Mm-hmm.
Yes, certainly. The first is financial, and that is, I think, best illustrated by the patient assistance programs. This is where patients cannot afford the drugs, and so they can apply to essentially receive the drugs at no cost from the drug companies. The second is geographic, and we know that oftentimes a prescription might be given to a patient, but because of their distance from a pharmacy or because of the hours of operation of the pharmacy, the patient can't fill it. We do have some nurse practitioners who actually work in migrant clinics, one in particular who works and on a van that goes from migrant clinic to migrant clinic. So in that case, it would be both a geographic issue and a financial issue. And so we have attempted to craft the amendments around a lack of readily available access, which could be geographic, it could be financial as well.
Yes.
So for those, so a nurse practitioner who would be able to have medications in their clinic or in their office, and for those patients who she or he knows wouldn't be able to go to a pharmacist or who didn't have money to buy the mm-hmm. prescriptions, that's when they would dispense. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, they aren't going to become pharmacists. Can you explain the difference between those that would normally be sent to a pharmacy and then mm-hmm. what dispensing would be involved in?
Yes, certainly. The dispensing authority is desired just to deal with those unusual circumstances where either the patient is unable to afford or unable to get to a source of drugs. And dispensing in that way goes on all over the healthcare system. As an emergency room nurse, I dispense drugs every night after the pharmacies close. They're pre-labeled. They're already packaged in such a way that they're a very short-term supply, and it generally is because someone needs it now and can't wait until morning when they can go to a pharmacy. But in the case of nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists, it would be for a short-term dose, perhaps, and particularly for those patients who can't get there, either can't get there geographically or can't get there because they have no money.
Okay. Sure, follow.
There, just today, I had gotten information that there was opposition or concerns regarding 709 in particular. Mm-hmm. And what the concern is the training. Mm-hmm. And I know that Representative Verger addressed that a little bit, but I don't think it was explained fully enough regarding the type of training that a nurse specialist has.
Okay, certainly. Clinical nurse specialists have at a minimum a master's degree, so their academic credential equals that of a nurse practitioner. They all must be registered nurses, and in Oregon, our latest statistics collected in August of 2002 indicate that clinical nurse specialists in this state have an average of 6 to 10 years of experience as an RN prior to becoming a certified or clinical nurse specialist. So they were experienced RNs prior to their graduate program. The graduate program for clinical nurse specialists differs from a nurse practitioner in that it is generally focused around a particular specialty, not dealing with adults, but dealing perhaps with adults who have cancer or adults who have psychological problems. So they're not educated to be primary care providers where they would see a wide range of health problems, but rather they are educated to deal with specialty problems.
Okay. Anything further? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. See, Gary Schnabel, Tom Holt, bring you. Come on up together.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I'm really just here today to reaffirm that the bill. Bills before you, 708 and 709, reflect conversations between our association and the Nurses Association on the Senate side. And at this point, our association is neutral on these bills, and I'd be happy to answer questions that you all may have.
Representative Phillips.
So, Tom, the letter that we have before us from the Board of Pharmacy, is this what you're addressing? That this no longer...
Representative, we have Mr. Schnabel is here for the Board of Pharmacy.
I'll withdraw my question.
Go ahead.
My name is Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present testimony on behalf of the Board of Pharmacy in opposition of Senate Bill 708 and 709. I'll try to make this come together. Since Senate hearings, these have been heard together and then separately, and my testimony has been put together and then separated and put together. Now it's separated today. Well, so you're hearing them together. But I think it'll make sense when I say it to you. Last week I submitted that letter to Representative Doyle as chair of the committee describing the board's primary objections to 708 and 709, and I would just briefly like to review the high points of that letter. The Board of Nursing and the Board of Pharmacy have jointly worked to develop current requirements for nurse practitioner dispensing in certain drug outlets registered by the Board of Pharmacy, including college student health centers, county health clinics, and family planning clinics, as well as provisions for emergency dispensing authority. The Board of Pharmacy believes that the current dispensing authority for nurse practitioners should not be expanded as Senate Bill 708 proposes, and that the need for this expansion has not been demonstrated. This expansion would increase the risk of errors and would not serve the public interest. The Board of Pharmacy believes that the increased exposure and access to narcotics and other controlled substances will increase the risk and the occurrence of illegal drug diversion. The Board of Pharmacy believes that dispensing by a practitioner provides a lesser level of patient care than dispensing by a pharmacist. This is because the practitioner focuses on the examination, evaluation, diagnosis, treatment options, and office procedures, while under increasing pressure to see more patients with less time. Pharmacists, on the other hand, focus on the review and evaluation of the prescription, drug product selection, preparation, packaging, and proper labeling, drug utilization review, drug interaction screening, adverse event monitoring, drug information counseling and professional advice, acquisition, storage, and disposal of drugs, and the required documentation and record keeping. That is, pharmacists provide the necessary focus and the all-important safety check for prescribing practitioners. Both are missing when the practitioner dispenses. Indeed, the definition of dispensing, ORS 689005, contemplates a separate prescriber and dispenser. There are several technical problems, I think, with Senate Bill 708. In Section 1, on page 1, lines 20 and 21, Board of Nursing is required to notify the Board of Pharmacy of the receipt of an application. However, there's no requirement in here to notify the Board of Pharmacy when an application is approved. I think receipt of an application is not useful information. We don't know if it was completed or if it was ever approved. Again, Section 1, page 4, line 7 and line 9 establish labeling and record-keeping requirements consistent with ORS Chapter 689. However, no provision for security requirements is proposed as currently exists in Chapter 689, and failing to address security of a drug inventory and dispensing area is a significant omission. Section 1, page 2, line 15 allows a Board of Pharmacy representative to inspect the dispensing site or the drug outlet upon receipt of a complaint by the Board of Nursing. However, ORS 689-115 Subsection 8 authorized the Board of Pharmacy representative to, at all reasonable hours in the performance of the duties, and this is a quote, enter or cause its authorized representative to enter upon and examine the premises or records required by law of any drug outlet. This clearly illustrates the intent and the Board of Pharmacy's authority over autonomous and unannounced inspection of drug outlets. Section 1, page 2, line 18, provides that the Board of Nursing has sole disciplinary authority regarding certified nurse practitioners who have dispensing authority. ORS 689.405, subsection 1, states, State Board of Pharmacy may refuse to issue or renew or may suspend, revoke, or restrict the license of any person or the certificate of registration of any drug outlet upon one or more of the following grounds. And a number of grounds are listed, including violations of the pharmacy or drug laws of this state or rules pertaining thereto, or of the statutes, rules, regulations of any other state or federal government. This illustrates the intent and the Board of Pharmacy's authority over the drug outlets and the individuals who have responsibility for the drug outlets regarding pharmacy or drug law violations. Also, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, also there is no provision in either one of these bills requiring the nurse practitioners to dispense only to their own patients as is required by other practitioners. Physicians can only dispense to their own patients and they have to do so personally. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in conclusion, having said all this, pertaining to the broad nature of Senate Bill 708, a simpler alternative might exist. Current existing language authorizes the Board of Nursing to accept applications from nurse practitioners for emergency dispensing for rural areas. By simply amending the criteria for defining emergency, you can see this on page 1, lines 8 to 18, that's being proposed to be deleted. Rather than deleting that section, and Section 2, page 3, lines 15 to 27, and adding the bold text on page 1, the Board of Nursing could include the conditions applicable to the patients being contemplated by the provisions of this bill in the definition, simply changing the definition of the emergency to include those folks would simplify and remove some of the questions. This would retain the special or emergency nature of nurse practitioner dispensing authority rather than the general or routine expensive dispensing. The Board of Pharmacy opposes the deletion of the sections from the existing statute. And I thank the committee for the opportunity to speak. I urge you to vote no on Senate Bill 708, 709. I'll answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Moss Sampson.
Thank you. Have you been in negotiations with the nurses, Oregon Nurses Association, on these two bills?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moss Anderson, we were for a while in the beginning, and after we haven't been in discussions with them since the bill passed the Senate.
Okay, because it sounds like a follow up. It sounds like you are proposing some changes that would maybe make these bills more palatable to the board. Is that correct,
Mr. Chair? Representative Moss Anderson, I think that's correct. Mm-hmm. I can't speak for the board at this point, but these are changes that would allow me to go back to the board with a recommendation.
Okay. And then one further. You were saying that you didn't feel that there was a need, and do you know how many nurse practitioners are practicing independently?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moss, or Representative Moss Anderson, I don't know that.
There are a number of nurse practitioners that are dealing with a number of patients that, that don't have access to a physician or do not want to have a physician as their provider. And there are also low income. And how do you respond to the fact that then these nurse practitioners who have been prescribing and dispensing, administering drugs, or dispensing samples, aren't able to give the quality of care to those who would really need the medication?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moss Anderson, I don't want to speak negatively about the nurse practitioners or the need for nurse practitioners, and I see a nurse practitioner myself. That wasn't my intent. My concern is with the bill and the way it's written. The Board of Pharmacy believes that the dispensing authority that currently exists, along with the emergency provision with some teasing of the language, would take care of those situations where you say that the nurse practitioner couldn't provide the level of care.
Further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Schnabel, you indicate on a couple of areas here that one of your concerns is with risk of patient injury due to prescribing and dispensing errors on the part of nurse practitioners or nurse specialists. Do you have any data that suggests what the level of injury or malpractice might be in that regard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, data is really difficult to get a hold of. The only data we have in our agency is data that's reported by a consumer complaint. And we can provide that kind of data, but we have no idea how many errors occur or how many patients are really injured. We see a fraction, some fraction of that, but we only see what we're notified of by a consumer complaint.
Then do you have a, and I would appreciate seeing what information you might have in that regard, but do you have a thought or a precept of what those numbers might look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, the Institutes of Medicine put out a report, the famous IOM report that you may have heard of, I don't know, that about medical errors, and a fraction of those medical errors were referred to as medication errors, and they measured injuries and deaths, and that report indicates that somewhere around 7,000 people die every year from medication errors. What I saw in that report didn't separate out which profession was doing the dispensing, or whether it was a dispensing error or whether it was an administration error in the hospital. I mean, medication errors and injuries is a serious problem, but I am not able to point a finger at anybody. I think we're all human, and, you know, rational people do rational things, but errors happen.
Further questions? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering about types of drugs that would be dispensed. Can you tell me, I believe morphine is an opium-based drug, is it not?
Of course, that's correct.
What percentage of drugs that are dispensed are opium-based?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Close, that would definitely fluctuate with different practices. Some pharmacies or individual practice with a high number of pain management type patients, cancer patients, arthritis. In a practice like that, it could probably be 50% of their drugs. In an average corner drugstore, probably 30%.
Follow up.
I guess my concern is that you're opening up this universe of drugs that, you know, are illegal in other circumstances, and I'm worried about the abuse of that, I guess. Could you address that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Close, that's a concern that the Board of Pharmacy has and that they expressed in the letter. States around the country have loosely referred to as recovery programs or programs for chemically dependent physicians, pharmacists, nurses. Statistics I've seen indicate somewhere around 10% of a profession is probably chemically dependent, or I don't think these programs actually have that many. I know ours doesn't, and there are a lot of people who are chemically dependent or need help or don't get in the program, but that's the figure that most people talk about with any profession is about 10%.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Berger.
I'm just kind of curious about you're pointing out about the ORS statutes, which of course does give you the authority to go and look at dispensing sites. It also gives you the authority over the person that is dispensing the medicine. But if you get a complaint and you visit a dispensing site, what does that tell you just to go and visit a site after a complaint that perhaps there's someone that doesn't know how to dispense medicine? I'm not sure of how I get a connection between those two things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, when we receive a complaint, actually we do routine inspections of these facilities whether we get a complaint or not. The pharmacies are inspected annually. Mm-hmm. We can only review or visit drug outlets that are registered with the board. And that was our concern with this bill. But currently, the College Student Health Centers and County Clinic and Family Planning Clinic are registered with the Board of Pharmacy, and we could visit them or investigate when we get a complaint. To answer your question, when we get a complaint, we would visit the pharmacy. We would interview the pharmacist, all employees that had anything to do with that prescription. We pull the records up for that prescription for that day. I mean, we just basically exhaust their knowledge of the incident and then try to piece together what happened and whether it was just a mistake or whether there's an issue of competence or an issue of impairment with what goes on. We can tell a lot from the way the questions are answered and the way the records are kept and the way the drugs are stored.
Further questions? Oh, Representative Barnhart.
This might be a bit off the topic, if it is. Just let me know that. But I'm assuming that when you're dispensing drugs, so security is an issue. Security of the facility itself and of the drugs themselves.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart. We have several pages in our regulations about security of the prescription area and who can have access to keys, and nobody can be in that area, the locked area, unless there's a pharmacist present. The technicians, clerks, other people can't be in that area where the drugs are stored unless the pharmacist is there. lots of record-keeping requirements, inventory requirements, what to do if the pharmacist has to leave the pharmacy for a while. Security of that prescription area is a major concern of the board.
And are those areas adequately addressed in these bills from the point of view of your board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnard, I didn't see that there was anything addressing security at all in either one of these bills.
Okay. Chair Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what the most commonly prescribed drug is in just a regular nurse practitioner clinic setting? I would think it would be penicillin, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Moss Anderson, we can print a list. You can probably even get it on the web of the top 200, and it lists them by dollar or by number of doses. And I don't know off the top of my head, the antidepressants and the antibiotics are high. The cholesterol-lowering drugs are high. Probably Lipitor, those drugs are the highest. Vicodin is up there fairly high. That's a real common and popular opiate derivative.
When I think of a sick child who has strep throat and is from low income, and it just seems to me that, again, I get back to this quality of care and access, that we want that child treated as quickly as possible, and so it doesn't spread as well as the patient gets well. So that's just a comment. You don't need to respond.
I will.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanderson, I agree with you, and we would want that person treated too. We're believing, though, that we could get to that point with the emergency dispensing, that we didn't need to go this broad. That's just our feeling, if you know.
Okay. Thank you for testimony.
One more comment, certainly, which I didn't share earlier. The samples, drug samples, are not considered dispensing under the definition. So nurse practitioners are allowed right now to have and to distribute drug samples in any setting.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Okay. And that's all who had signed up to testify, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 708, 709. And we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 886. Senator Shields. Afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm State Senator Frank Shields from Senate District 24 in Portland. I've handed out testimony, but I've just changed my mind and decided not to go through the whole testimony, but to try to tell you what happened. At the beginning of this session, a lot of different legislators came up to me, and bluntly they said that, with all these budget cuts and stuff, the church... And that was their language, not mine. The church needs to get more involved in meeting human need. Recognizing that what has happened in Washington, D.C. has been kind of evolving over the last few years. As far back as 1996, there was a faith-based initiative that was presented as part of the Welfare Reform Act. And then in 2001, there was a faith-based initiative established in the president's office. Both of those became more faith-based / community-based initiatives. And that's obvious. And the reason for it's obvious, at least to me. If you don't have that, you have some problems with the whole issue of separation of church and state. And so what I did in this bill, please notice that this bill is very bipartisan. There's about a dozen folks who are co-sponsors. It's very carefully Republican and Democrat, because within both of our communities, I think that we ought to find ways where faith-based and community-based organizations can help people who come to the Department of Human Services for services. If you happen to belong to an Alliance Club and you happen to lose your job, then you went to DHS and you were approved for food stamps and you were approved for, you know, a small TANF grant. Wouldn't it make sense if, in addition to that small grant that you got, you were somehow connected back to your Lions Club? You're already a member of it. Why not take advantage of that particular connection that you've got? They might help you network in some way to find work. They might be involved in mentoring. Basically, they're doing things that would encourage you. This bill suggests that the state should always keep track of the money, whether it's TANF money, food stamp money, or whatever. But faith-based and community organizations can keep track of that person's, well, not keep track of, that's a wrong word, but a faith or community-based organization can certainly do a whole lot in terms of encouraging that person, mentoring that person, helping that person move through a difficult point in their life. You know, we're trying here to deal with the whole person. Somebody comes to the welfare office, you're looking at their needs for food, for you know, all kinds of resources. Why not look at their assets as well as their needs? And if one of the assets that they have is that they're a member of a synagogue or a church or a community-based organization, factor that in when you're trying to help them. That's what this bill's about. I talked with the Speaker of the House about it more than a month ago. She was quite interested in the bill. It came out of the Senate 29-1. We met with the ACLU, talked with them about concerns they had, talked with a broad diversity of community groups. I do have amendments to it that we didn't have time to get to on the Senate side. Basically, they simply make sure that if an organization, for instance, if you're getting welfare and you're related to the Catholic Church, just because somebody says, let's quit doing this, let's back out of this relationship, let's withdraw from this relationship with regard to this pilot project, it doesn't file up anything with regard to Catholic charities in general. You know, it's specific to this project. On page 2 of the bill, line 42, there's a longer statement that we have shortened. It says the activities, well, it says the department can terminate or withdraw from this program if, and then point B, the activities or services provided by the faith-based or community-based organization, and then cut out about the next 10 words, impede the ability of the department to effectively provide services. So we've built in almost redundant systems into this bill to make sure that there aren't problems with it. I'm becoming aware that I'm not doing a very good job of explaining this bill. Maybe I should back up and let you ask questions or just read a rather lengthy testimony. But it's basically an attempt to allow church and community-based organizations to help DHS in helping people out in the community, especially those people with whom they already have a relationship of some sort. And with that, I guess I would be open for questions rather than talking this thing to death.
Okay. Any questions? First time on a Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where was the funding? I know you directs the DHS to establish at least one pilot program. Where would funding come from?
This had, and maybe the department, I know there's a representative of the department here that's probably better able to answer the question. Right now, the Department of Human Services already has numerous volunteer programs. The only point at which this may have a fiscal impact would be in training volunteers from out in the community, whether from a community-based or a faith-based organization, to interface with the Department of Human Services, knowing their confidentiality issues and, you know, knowing what they can and can't do. And since they're already training volunteers, they gave it a kind of a non-existent fiscal. That makes sense. We wanted specifically for this not to cost more money. If I can take it a step further, I would suggest to you that I believe, and this is just my belief, I have no proof of this, but if you had a person who was receiving TANF and food stamps and they were out there on their own, they probably wouldn't do as well as somebody that was receiving TANF and food stamps, plus the moral support, mentoring, whatever, of a faith-based or community-based organization that they belong to. So my idea was that it actually helped the state's dollars go farther. That's what's behind the bill, aside from helping people, of course.
Further questions?
I realize that you're probably just getting acquainted with this bill. I'm sorry I didn't have any time to push it on the House side. After we got it out of the Senate 29 to nothing, I kind of forgot about it until today. My apologies.
That's okay. And, I mean, this was the purpose today, Senator. It was just to get the public airing on it on our end, and we'll be able to revisit this again later. Other questions, Senator?
Okay. If anybody has more questions, feel free to call my office. I'd be glad to. I'm usually much more articulate on this bill, but my head is in a gravel pit somewhere right now with an aggregate bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Close.
If I could just say, I appreciate what Senator Shields has done. This is it's a new area that needs a lot of work, and I appreciate you trying to bring more aspects into this discussion, and it looks very interesting to me. I intend to study it more.
Well, I think we've, as I pointed out in the first page, we made bipartisan mistakes on this in the past, but I think we can, in a bipartisan way, make some course corrections and at least take care of some of our people out here.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Ramona Rodemaker.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee. My name is Ramona Rodemaker. I work in the Department of Human Services as a policy advisor in the director's office. I'm here today to testify in support of the concept behind Senate Bill 886. However, the bill, as currently written, does have a fiscal impact that is not in the governor's budget, although it is not a large fiscal impact. This bill requires the Department of Human Services to establish a pilot project in at least one service delivery area in which we identify clients that we are serving who have existing relationships with faith or community-based organizations. If they do have existing relationships, we ask them if they would like our assistance to work with that organization to receive services that are in support of their case plan and what we're providing them, and then provide training and establish procedures to work with those faith and community-based organizations to make them aware of public assistance and the services we provide, as well as volunteers and programs. The primary area of concern when we talk about working with faith and community-based organizations is in safeguarding the client's confidentiality and making sure that these are voluntary programs. This bill addresses all of those. It is, at every step of the way, the client's choice as to whether or not they want to engage in this program, and their relationship is with the Department of Human Services and, again, with the faith and community-based organization. So there's no real conflict of interest there in terms of providing information and working with the clients. The department has a long history of working with faith and community-based organizations to help alleviate poverty and surrounding issues. We see this as a potential to increase those partnerships and to increase awareness of how to help the individuals who are working with both the department and with faith and community-based organizations. This has the potential to provide a framework within which the department could further improve the coordination and service delivery to low-income Oregonians. The one issue we have with the fiscal statement, and right now the fiscal impact is estimated at about $44,000, which is not a high fiscal impact. It's with the language in the bill around the training. Right now the bill says that the department shall provide training on public assistance and the services it provides, as well as volunteerism. If there are a way to modify that language so that we could plug representatives of faith and community-based organizations into existing trainings rather than creating new training opportunities, we believe the fiscal issue would be alleviated. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today. If you have any questions, please let me know.
Any questions? Representative Monica Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm familiar in Virginia, where I worked for a few years in public health, but it was rural Virginia, and we actually had clinics in churches. That's where we went. And I'm wondering, in Oregon, are there services that go into churches at all that you're aware of? That provide some kind of services, whether it's public health or immunizations or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, we have a variety of different types of relationships with faith-based and community organizations. Everything from working with congregations of churches to provide a core volunteer set, to working and developing mentoring programs for individuals who are part of a particular organization. We have relationships like that. We also have formal relationships in which we contract with faith-based and community organizations to provide services as well. And that would be with organizations such as Catholic Charities or Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. As we also have developed different relationships in which we do work with organizations to help them provide support services, such as this bill is suggesting. While I'm not aware particularly of clinics that are in faith-based organizations, we do support child care, homeless shelters, all kinds of faith-based human services currently.
Further questions? Okay, thank you. And just to note, committee, statement from the Senate came out that when LFO reviewed this, it was minimal fiscal impact, which I guess under the guidelines is less than $50,000. And certainly with this human services budget's over $1 billion, that's why it's not why you won't see any further fiscal impact study on this. Let's see, nobody else to schedule testify on this, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 886. And open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 538. Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of Senate Bill 538 with a couple of caveats. This bill makes changes to the definition of mass gathering. It actually changes the provisions in Chapter 197 relating to land use, that contain the definition of land use decision. The idea behind this bill, and it's akin to Senate Bill 99, which I was involved in the 1999 session, is to exempt out from the land, from the zoning ordinance, gatherings that do not exceed either 3,000 people cumulatively or 120 hours in any consecutive 3-month period, In other words, people who use their property for such things as weddings or political rallies or what have you would not be regulated under the zoning ordinance. They would be regulated by the cities and counties under their health and safety codes. That's the intent of Senate Bill 538. That was the intent of Senate Bill 99 in the 1999 session, but there have been problems that have arisen with the actual application of Senate Bill 99. I know the A. M. Gross version of SB 538 is designed to fix that. The caveat now, I have not worked at all on SB 538. Ross Day from my office has been working on this bill this session. Mass gatherings is a section of the law that at least that I find personally, if you don't spend a fair amount of time working on it, then it becomes very even more so than most land use provisions, it becomes very foreign very quickly. And so I don't think I'd be able to answer any detailed technical questions on SB 538. I think Mr. Day would be better qualified to do that. I also know that he worked very closely on the amendments to Senate Bill 538, resulting in the Angros version with Ron Eber of the DLCD. I believe Mr. Eber is in San Francisco today at his mother's funeral. So the two people who have worked the closest on this bill unfortunately aren't here, and so you're stuck with the substitute. And since I haven't spent as much time on this bill as I did in 1999 with SB 99, I don't think I can answer any technical questions. So what I'm hopeful that the committee will do, if they're interested in moving this bill, is hold off until the folks that have been working on this session can come in and answer some questions. Answer your more technical questions if you have them.
Okay. I think one question you might be able to carry back to them is whether this would authorize events such as the Hemp Festival that's near Harrisburg.
Sure.
And just see if we can get that answered. Other questions?
And the Country Fair in Lane County. Mm-hmm. Would be another one that I know about.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Chair Doyle, I can't say I think that one of the rationale behind this bill, or at least one of the situations that I'm familiar with, there's a bed and breakfast in Marion County who near Shampooey, and in conjunction with that bed and breakfast, they hold weddings at the site. The county has taken the position that they can have one wedding within any 3-month period. And of course, the folks that typically what happens is the bride and groom, and or the bride's parents or the groom's parents or somebody involved in the wedding stays there, and then it's a nice setting, and then they have the wedding there. And now there's some question about whether or not these folks would be able to do that, whether it would be regulated under the zoning ordinance or whether, as we believe, it should be more properly regulated under the health and safety code so that the county can make sure that you know, the traffic is taken care of if there's traffic problems, that food service is taken care of if there's food service problems, but that they don't have to go through a 6-month procedural process and followed up by a LUBA appeal and an appeal to the Court of Appeals in order to have a wedding at their bed and breakfast. And that's part of what's trying to be resolved.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berger.
Yes. Fence versus Jackson County, can you tell me what that is? Does that have anything to do with the Corsons gathering there at a church?
Chair Doyle, Representative Verger, 4 years ago I could have told you exactly what the holding in Fence was. Fence versus Jackson County was, I believe, both LUBA and the Oregon Court of Appeals held that mass gatherings are not part of the land use code. They're not zoning decisions. I believe that's the proper holding, but don't hold me to that because I haven't read Fence since 1999. That's what we tried to do in Senate Bill 99 and in 1999, and believed that we had accomplished that But as I say, based on, at least from our, from what I know, the case in Marion County, it's obvious that some of the counties disagree with that interpretation.
Well, the reason that it caught my eye is Jackson County. I'm not sure, but it seems to me that the Corsons draw about 1,000 people a weekend for their outdoor church service there. That's outside. Maybe that's not the right county, but still, in all, 3,000, you know, consecutively in a 3-month period, they would far exceed that.
Chair Doyle, Representative Verger, there's been all kinds of talk about the number. I know that the number 3,000 was originally picked. This is the sort of the history behind it, by Governor McCall back in the early 70s when they were trying to keep the I'd call them hippies. I don't know what the politically correct term is, but when they were trying to keep those folks away from. I think the VFW had a convention in Portland, and they wanted to have some rock concert, so they were trying to shift those folks over to the rock concert, and that was the purpose behind the mass gathering statute in the first place.
That was the anti-war concern at the time, and he was trying to keep those two groups separated.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. He succeeded.
Okay. We'll bring it back. Thank you. And nobody else is scheduled to testify on this, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 538. And nothing else before the committee. Okay, we are adjourned.